Hello, and welcome to Audio Journal's Radioactive Theater, a series of programs presenting outstanding radio dramas for our listening audience. Radioactive Theater is supported in part by grants from the Webster Five Foundation and the Worcester Arts Council, a local agency, which is supported by the Massachusetts Cultural Council, a state agency. This program features two episodes of Gunsmoke, with Jeff Van Amberg as Matt Dillon, Nicole Spadafino as Miss Kitty, John McManaman as Doc, John Goodale as Chester, Bill Mercado as Ben Stansel, Joe Aguirre as Foss Capper, and Jen Antkowiak as Carrie. Listeners tuned in to Gunsmoke on the radio from 1952 to 1961 and then viewed it on television from 1955 to 1975. You can still view it on cable today. It was seen as the realistic adult Western, setting it apart from the Cisco Kid and the Lone Ranger, viewed as being aimed at young people. This is the theme they heard. Gunsmoke is an American Western drama series created by Norman MacDonald and John Meston. The story takes place in and around Dodge City during the settlement of the American West. The central character is lawman Marshall Dillon, played by William Conrad on radio, and James Arness on TV. Gunsmoke was nominated for and won numerous Primetime Emmy Awards. And now our first episode of Gunsmoke and Marshall Dillon, Cheap Labor.
I'm that man, Matt Dillon, United States Marshal. The first man they look for and the last they want to meet. It's a chancy job, but it makes a man watchful and a little lonely.
So your name's Foss Capper, huh?
Yeah, that's right, mister.
Well, you say your name out like you got nothing to hide.
Well, now you're right again.
Well, I guess a man who wanted to hide something needs to be wearing a gun to help him do it.
Maybe.
Well, you agreeing with me or aren't you agreeing with me?
Any way you want it, mister.
Yeah, you're big, Capper. I ain't afraid of you.
There's no reason you should be.
Yeah, you're awful big. He'd be a fool to go against you without a gun, wouldn't he? Well, wouldn't he?
Mister, have a drink.
No, here, you have this instead. I always carry an extra gun in my belt.
I don't want your gun.
Well, I can't fight you less than you got a gun. You're too big.
We got no cause to fight, mister. Now you take your gun back.
You're afraid. You're a coward. You're stinking...
Don't you push it, mister.
I said you're a coward.
All right, feller. You've had enough.
Now you keep out of this.
I am wearing a gun, mister, and I'll bend it across your skull in a minute.
Oh, you're the marshal.
Get out of here. Go on, move.
Sure.
Well, suppose I ought to thank you, Marshal.
No need.
Name's Foss Capper.
You know, most men around Dodge do wear guns, Capper.
I've had enough of fighting, Marshal.
Oh, and where was that?
Why, the war. Had it from Harper's Ferry all the way to Richmond, you know. A man gets tired of killing.
Yeah, I know.
Mr. Dillon?
Yeah, what is it, Chester?
Mr. Dillon, Ben Stensel's out there in the street.
So?
Well, he's about to beat up one of his riders.
Oh, I suppose it has to do with his sister again, huh?
Yes, sir, it sure does. And Carrie's there, too.
All right, let's go.
Ah!
I declare that poor Carrie. Mr. Dillon, she was trying to load their wagon all by herself, and this rider of Stancil's come along, and, well, he was helping her when Stancil himself come up and got real sore about it.
Stancil doesn't deserve a sister like Carrie.
Well, she's as nice as he is mean and ugly. There they are.
Yeah.
Well, say, where's that cowboy at?
Oh, he's lying on the ground behind Stancil.
Well, I sure didn't hear no shooting.
Get back to looting that stuff, Carrie. Did you hear me?
Yes, I hear you, Ben.
Well, I hope you didn't kill him, Stancil.
He's all right, Marshal. I only knocked him down.
Well, I'll go get some water from over there and...
I should have killed him.
For what? Trying to help Carrie do a man's work?
Carrie's my sister, Marshal. What she does ain't no business of yours.
No, but your keeping men away from her the way you do is going to lead to real trouble one of these days.
My trouble, Marshal.
Not if you kill somebody. You know, I guess men don't like the way you treat her. There's somebody else trying to help her.
What?
Now, just take it easy, Stancil. That man's not wearing a gun.
Then you better go get one.
There you are, ma'am.
What do you think you're doing, stranger?
Well, that box seemed a little heavy for a lady to be lifting.
Please, Ben, he meant no harm.
You know this man?
Well, he told me his name.
Carrie, you're turning into a regular devil.
Now, I wouldn't talk like that, mister.
You shut up!
There's been enough fighting for one day. Stancil, your wagon's loaded, so why don't you get going?
All I can say to you, mister, you better get yourself a gun. Get up on the seat, Carrie.
Good day, Miss Carrie.
Goodbye, Mr. Kappa.
Oh, but...
Well, how'd you get mixed up in this, Capper?
I was curious, so I followed you out. Then I seen her struggling with that box. Couldn't just stand there and watch her, could I?
Uh-huh. You just remember something. Someday, Stancil's gonna kill somebody over her.
Well, I sure hope it won't be me.
Then you know what to do, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, I know what to do, Marshal.
Hi, Kitty. You shopping?
Well, I guess a woman's always shopping, Matt, whether she buys anything or not.
I believe that. Well, now.
Hmm? What?
That's Carrie Stancil.
Oh, well, sure.
But isn't that false Capper driving her wagon?
Well, where you been the last few weeks, Matt? He drives her wagon every time she comes to town.
He does?
Well, sure. He rides out and meets her partway, ties his horse behind, and they drive in together.
And this has been going on for a couple of weeks, you say?
Oh, well, at least.
Then Stancil hasn't found out, I take it.
I doubt if Capper's ever showed himself anywhere near the ranch, Matt.
Why? You think he's afraid?
Don't you?
Maybe he only wants to avoid a fight.
Isn't that the same thing?
No, not necessarily, Kitty.
Well, if he wasn't a coward, he'd be wearing a gun, wouldn't he?
I don't know, Kitty. I haven't decided about false Capper.
Oh, look at them, Matt. They're so wrapped up in each other, they don't even see us.
No, false. This is the last time. It has to be.
I hope I don't bring you no trouble, Carrie. But I ain't gonna stop seeing you.
Huh. She's smarter than he is.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, I guess she'll never be able to get away from that brother of hers. Oh, Matt, look.
Yeah.
There's gonna be trouble, Matt. Stancil looks awful mad.
Well, I don't like to interfere in family matters, but this time, I guess I'd better.
What's going on, Carrie?
Please, Ben, let's talk about it at home, not here.
We're gonna settle this here and now. And you ain't gonna stop it, Marshal.
I just wanted to make sure you remember that false Capper doesn't carry a gun, Stancil.
Dirty coward. Of course he doesn't.
A gun wouldn't solve anything, Stancil.
It'd get you killed. That'd solve things.
Maybe for you, not for Carrie.
I don't even want to hear you saying a name.
You're going to have to hear it. Now it's gone on long enough, Stancil, the way you treat her.
What I do with Carrie ain't no business of yours.
I want Carrie to marry me.
Foss, you never told me that.
Well, I've been thinking on that, Carrie. I figured to wait, but I guess there ain't time now for waiting.
Oh, Foss.
Carrie's worked hard for you, Stancil, and you never gave her a thing of her own. You kept everybody from her for fear of losing her. She ain't a woman to you, a sister. She's nothing but cheap labor.
I'll kill you sure now.
No, you won't, because you'd hang for it.
I'll get you, Kappa, one way or the other.
Carrie?
Yes?
You go on back to the ranch and get what things you need. I'll be waiting right here for you tomorrow noon.
No, Carrie!
You can't stop us, Stancil. You're going to be free, Carrie. You can make up your mind later about marrying me, but you're going to be free.
Carrie?
Stancil, you shut up. And don't lay a finger on her, or I'll just beat you to death. Go on now, Carrie.
All right, Foss.
Noon tomorrow, Carrie. I'll be waiting. And you mind what I said, Stancil. Don't you try to stop her.
I won't try to stop her. It's you I'm gonna stop.
Now you know, Marshal, I didn't mean to cause trouble when I come here.
Well, maybe not, Capper, but you sure done it.
Mr. Dillon.
Yeah, what is it, Chester?
You'd better get on out there quick. It's fixing to happen. Ben Stancil just rode in with two of his men.
Has Carrie showed up yet?
No, sir, she ain't. But Foss Capper was waiting for her when them others came in.
I didn't think Stancil would let her go without a fight.
Oh, there's gonna be a fight, all right, of some kind. Look how they're crowding.
Capper! I'm gonna fix you good.
I see you brought plenty of help.
Well, you're too big for one man to handle, but the three of us can do it.
No, you don't, Stancil.
You keep out of this, Marshal.
You don't think I'm going to stand by and watch three men work over one, do you?
Wait, Marshal.
Yeah? What, Capper?
Now, there ain't no other way. I'll take them on. All of them. It's got to be done.
Wait a minute. Look who's coming yonder.
Carrie. I told her to go back home.
What in the world's the matter with her? She looks like she got drugged.
You keep away from her, Kappa.
Shut up, Stancil. Leave him be.
What happened to you?
They caught up with me at the edge of town.
Here, I'll help you down.
I got here anyway. He couldn't stop me.
Did your brother do this to you? Did he knock you around?
You get back on that wagon and go home, Carrie.
All right, hold it, Stancil. Let her talk.
Carrie, did he do it?
Yes.
You sure need convincing, Carrie.
I told you to shut up, Stancil.
Chester?
Yeah?
Would you be good enough to take Carrie over to Miss Kitty's? Because I got a little business here.
I'd be glad to.
Don't you move, Stancil.
You come with me, Carrie.
All right, boys. Let's get to work.
Now, just a minute, Stancil. I've changed my mind.
What?
I ain't going to fight you. Not now. Not that way. We're going to settle this. For good and all.
What are you talking about?
Marshal Dillon, could I ask you a favor?
What, Capper?
Lend me your gun. Well?
All right, here it is.
Thank you.
Now what's this? What are you two doing? Who ever heard of a lawman lending his gun?
I think Capper's right, Stancil. This business has got to be settled for good. And he's the one to do it, not me.
Okay, then. You can watch him die. You ready, boys?
Now, wait a minute, Stancil. You didn't say nothing about no gunfighting.
What difference does that make?
There's something about him. I don't like the way he wears that gun. He looks kind of professional to me.
He's nothing but a tin horn, and he's a coward at that.
He ain't no coward. I ain't having no part of this. Come on, Bob. Let's don't be fools.
Light a fire! Both of you!
Good.
Stancil?
Was he right, Capo? Are you a gunman?
You can find out. Easy enough.
You gonna stand there and allow this, Marshal?
I can't stop it now.
Well, I think he's a gunman. I think he's a killer.
Stancil, you're through. Get going.
Well.
Marshal, your gun. I thank you.
Sure.
You remember I told you how a man gets tired of killing?
I had a feeling it was more than the war that did it, Capper.
I was all through wearing a gun. That's why I asked Carrie to marry me.
So?
You tell her for me, Marshal. Tell her I was ready to kill her brother. I can't ask her to marry me now. The day will always come when I'll have to put on a gun again.
Not against Stancil.
Well, there's others. Man like me's got enemies.
Why don't you tell her about it yourself, Capper?
Wouldn't be fair. I'd be influencing her the wrong way just being there. Will you do it?
It's too late.
Huh?
Look behind you.
Oh.
She didn't go to Kitty's. She was waiting to see what happened. Yeah. She saw you, Capper. Gun and all. She doesn't look like she's coming to tell you goodbye.
No. No, she doesn't, does she?
Foss?
Our second Gunsmoke presentation is A Christmas Story.
Everything was all right up until about a mile north of the Cimarron. That's when my horse got a hoof caught in a frozen dog hole and broke his leg. So I had to shoot him. It made me feel awful bad. I didn't feel any better thinking about the walk ahead of me. Close to 40 miles to Dodge and carrying my saddle all the way. I guess I'd been on the trail about an hour. Near as I could figure, it was around 3 in the afternoon when I eased the saddle off my shoulders for a rest and a smoke. And that's when I saw a stranger riding up from the way I'd come. And he was tall and thin. His horse was taller and even thinner. Yeah, they made quite a pair.
Hi.
How are you?
You lost?
No, my horse busted his leg a ways back. I'm on my way to Dodge.
Oh, that's your horse, huh? I saw it. On your way to Dodge, huh?
Yeah, that's right.
Got any more of that tobacco?
Yeah, sure. Here you are.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
That's okay.
Kind of a big walk you got ahead, ain't it?
Kinda.
It's gonna be dark soon. You thinking of making camp?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not too bad. You need any food?
Nah, no thanks. I got enough.
Well, I thank you for the tobacco.
Sure. Anytime.
Hey!
Yeah?
I'm not saying this beast won't drop dead from the shock, but do you want to climb on behind? It'll save you a piece of boot leather for a while, anyway.
Well, I'd be much obliged if you think that animal of yours can carry us.
Well, she won't mind. She should have been dead a long time ago, except she don't know it. She don't mind.
Well, okay. Thanks. Say, here, will you hold my saddle till I get up, huh?
Sure. Give it here. Can you manage the saddle?
Yeah, I got it. Well, let's go. You heading for Dodge, too?
Not in particular. Just north.
Uh-huh.
This beast will do about 10 knots with the wind behind her, but we ain't gonna get more than 5 with this load. You ain't in no hurry, are you?
Well, I was kind of hoping to get there tonight. It's Christmas Eve, you know.
Oh, yeah. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah.
That backbone of hers sticking into you?
Oh, no, it's okay, thanks.
And Notice that tin doojigger tied to you. You the law?
Yeah, yeah. I'm a U.S. Marshal. My name's Matt Dillon.
That's so. I've never seen a marshal on foot.
Well, it happens sometimes.
How is it you're down this way? Ain't it a mite off your course? You marshal down here as well as Dodge?
No. I just took a prisoner across the Cimarron into Oklahoma Territory. Turned him over to the Army there.
Dead, eh?
And then he shut up tight. We must have ridden a couple of miles without a word. I got to thinking about Dodge and Chester, Doc Kitty, and the rest of them. You know, there's something pretty special about any place at Christmas time. The backbone of the stranger's nag was just about to split me in two when he talked up.
My name's Cowley. Amos Cowley. We better heave to a spell. She's breathing mighty hot. All right, hold up.
Well, it's getting a little chilly, isn't it?
Yeah. Could I trouble you for another smoke?
Oh, sure. Here you are.
I thank you. Say, what's it like in Dodge?
What?
Dodge, what's it like?
Oh, it's like any other town, I guess.
Pretty big, huh?
Well, yeah, I guess so. But not so big as New York, though.
Oh, no.
No, not as big as that.
You know, I haven't been in a big town now for more than 10 years.
Oh, is that so?
Nope. Been down the territories, drifting. Thought I'd move up north this time. Maybe go back east.
Oh, you're from the east, huh?
Sometime back. Say, what's it like?
What?
Dodge, any town, at Christmas. Same as it used to be?
Well, I guess so.
What do you do?
Well, same as most people, I guess. What most people do at Christmas.
Well, that ain't saying a lot. What are the folks like? And what does it look like? I just kind of like to know.
Well, I don't know. Well, there's Front Street. That's the most of Dodge right now. Of course, it's getting bigger all the time.
Do you have any kids?
No, I'm not married.
Yeah. Kids have fun at Christmas.
Yeah, they do. That's certain. In Dodge, they sometimes have a party for the kids a couple of days before Christmas. The kids like that. And then everybody's feeling good, looking forward to Christmas Eve, like last year. There was snow on the ground, but the sky was clear. You could even see the stars. I was going down the street to the Texas Trail to meet Chester and Doc. Chester, he's my deputy, and Doc's the doctor in town. We had some work to do later on in the evening. You could see the light shining behind the curtained windows, and almost everybody had a sprig of holly berries hanging up. They got some from the east a couple of days earlier. I remember running into John Bumby. He's a kind of general handyman in Dodge. He never says much, but he sure had a lot to say that night.
Oh, hello, Marshal.
Oh, hi, John.
A lovely night for Christmas Eve, isn't it?
It certainly is, John.
Yeah.
Really fine night.
Peace on earth and goodwill toward men, eh, Mr. Dillon?
Yeah, that's the way it should be, John.
You know, Marshal, this is going to be quite a night for me. Yes, sir.
Oh, that's so, John?
Oh, yes, sir. Tonight, I'm asking Ms. McNish to become Mrs. Bumby.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Why, John, I didn't know that.
I know it's been a mighty fast secret, but I'm popping the question tonight.
Well, I wish you a lot of luck, John. Hey, I'll tell you what. Come by to the Texas Trail later, and we'll have a drink on it.
I will. I really will, Marshal. You're good and kind, Marshal. Good and kind. Merry Christmas, Marshal. Merry Christmas.
Well, the same to you, John. That may sound kind of funny to you, but John Bumby's a good man. A little peculiar sometimes, but good as they come. And they don't make enough like him. Of course, most everybody in Dodge expected Doc and Kitty were sweet on each other. But it just goes to show you. I'll tell you about John and Ms. McNish a little later. So I went down the street. You know, it's a funny thing about those words, Merry Christmas. Men say it to each other, and, well, it makes them feel kind of good.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Used to be a seafaring man myself, and when you're on the sea and it comes to Christmas, things like that can, well, they can count a lot. Well, we might as well get underway again, eh?
Sure. You want to take my saddle?
Yeah, give it here.
There we are. Give it to me, huh?
Giddy up! I guess you'll miss it. In Dodge. Tonight, I mean. Won't
well,
you?
Well, if I could get a little more out of this nag of yours, we might make it.
Oh, there's not a chance. She'll be on her beam ends pretty quick. She's been on a long reach since sunup.
Oh.
Mighty bare country up this way.
Oh, it depends on what you're used to, I suppose.
Oh, it's mighty bare where I've been, too. It's not like the sea. That's always different.
How come you left it? I always heard a sailor doesn't ever get it out of his blood.
In the sea? I guess you can get it out of your blood, all right. If you got the right reason, you can.
Yeah, I guess so.
Hey, you trying to get something out of me?
Why, no. Get what? I was just remarking.
If you want to ride with me, I don't want any talk about the sea.
Well, you brought it up.
Hey, get here!
Almost like he couldn't stand the quiet. Or maybe he had things on his mind. He turned his head.
Go on.
What?
Go on. Tell me some more.
Oh, about Dodge?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know.
Well, you try some more, huh?
Well, they got a little pine tree in the Texas Trail.
A tree?
Yeah, it come down a long way from the north. Kitty Russell, she's the hostess in the Texas Trail. Well, she's got a lot of ribbon and gewgaws and made it look real nice. That was last Christmas.
Was a star at the top?
A star? Yeah, I think so. It looked like a star. I guess it sure looked pretty. Well, there was a difference in the place that day. Everybody was celebrating and feeling real good. The doors would swing open. Somebody'd come in, and maybe it was just somebody you knew to nod at. But because it was Christmas Eve, you'd come right up and say, hello. Well, maybe that's a good reason, and maybe not. I don't know. Anyhow, it was still kind of early, and Kitty and Chester were standing off looking at the tree.
Hi, Matt.
Evening, Mr. Dillon.
Hi, Kitty. Chester.
How you like it, Matt? The Christmas tree.
Oh, that's real pretty.
It's the only tree but one in the whole town.
No, no. Kate's got one over at the Isle of Fraganza.
Oh, I'll have to see it later. Where's Sam?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe he started celebrating too soon. Doc's taking over the bar.
That's right. That's right.
You want a drink, Kitty?
Sure.
I'll get you a drink. I'll get the drinks.
Hey, you haven't forgotten anything, have you, Mr. Dillon?
Forgotten? What, Chester?
There, what'd I tell you, Miss Kitty? I knew just as sure as my nose that he'd...
Oh, that. No, I haven't forgotten.
Oh, well, I thought as soon as we got Sam sober enough to take care of this customer, we could go over there to Doc's place like we planned.
Sure, we'll do that, Chester.
Hiya, Matt.
Ah, thanks, Doc.
Well, still snowing out.
No, it stopped. Where are you going, Kitty?
Oh, I just want to look outside is all. Oh, real pretty.
A man thinks a lot about things that don't mean much. Kitty, standing at the door, sniffing the cold air and the warmth inside and the whiskey in me. And it was a good feeling. And then Chester and me decided to take a bottle over to Mr. Hightower. He's a telegraph operator at the depot. He runs a printing shop on the side.
Hey, Mr. Dillon.
Yeah, Chester?
Do you mind if I stop by the church for a minute?
Why, no, I don't mind.
I just feel kind of right tonight, Mr. Dillon. Figure I ought to thank somebody before I...
Sure. So we stopped by the church. I'd never been much of a man for church, I guess, but I went along with Chester. Wasn't anybody else in there, just the two of us. Guess we sat for 10 minutes in that place. Chester a little way off with his head bowed. You know, there's a lot of peace in a church. Maybe it's the quiet, or maybe it's the good that people find in there. Well, whatever it was, it made a man feel glad about pretty much everything.
I haven't been in a church since I don't know when.
Oh, is that so?
Heave to. Well, she's becalmed again, mister.
Okay.
Well, she sure wasn't built for it, I'll tell you. You ever see anything like that?
Well, she is kind of old, ain't she?
I've had her going on 8 years, and she hasn't changed a mite. Eats like a pig and looks like a four-legged mizzenmast.
Smoke?
I don't mind. Hey, what about that fella Hightower? Did you get that bottle to him?
Oh, sure, yeah. I guess it was lonely over in the depot. He was glad for the company. There was a wood fire burning in the stove, but it didn't keep off the cold much.
Well, how are you, gents? Merry Christmas.
Well, how's it going, Mr. Hightower?
Oh, slow, Marshal, slow. A bit of excitement about an hour back, though.
That's so?
Oh, yeah. The 915 got stopped between here and Hutchinson. Lots of snow back air.
They're getting her out?
Oh, sure, they're trying, but I'm glad I'm not on it. It's going to be a cold night on that train.
Well, it's kind of chilly in here, isn't it, Mr. Hightower?
Well, any warmer, I'm going to go to sleep.
Say, we brought you over a bottle of Irish for company.
Jameson's? Well, I declare, I was just thinking about a time before you boys come in. Now that's real friendly. Will you have a drink with me?
We sure will.
Well, let's open her up, eh? There's a couple of glasses up there on the shelf, Chester. Get them down, will you?
I don't know if you get an idea about the folks in Dodge or not. They're not different from any other people, nor their town either. I guess maybe it's a pretty small place at that. The depot, the hall, a few stores, the church, Doc's office, the Texas Trail, Alafraganza, my office. They're not much, but it's where you live, you know?
Sounds all right. I lived in a town once back east. Small. I know what you mean.
Maybe you'll be going back.
Maybe. Say, kids, they still believe in St. Nick?
Sure.
Mighty few kids down where I've been. Injun kids. They don't believe in St. Nick.
No reason they should, I guess.
I used to believe in it. You know that?
I guess most people did at one time or another. Hey, you figure we've come maybe 10 miles?
Maybe.
Well, it's getting dark.
Yeah, well, come on. You want to ride in the saddle for a bit?
Oh, no, that's okay.
Well, then okay.
We rode on, and I thought about last year. About Kitty, Doc, Chester, and me going over to Doc's place after he got tired attending bar at the Texas Trail. It was about 12:45, and we stood around and sang Christmas carols.
We wish you a Merry Christmas, we wish you a Merry Christmas, we wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Say, that was fine. That was just fine.
Yeah, it sure was. What do you say if we...
Shh! Listen!
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas!
I feel sentimental. That's exactly how I feel. I feel sentimental.
I know what you mean, Doc. I surely know.
Okay, Doc. Bring him out.
And I remember how Doc scuttled over to the bureau and brought out some packages. The presents weren't much, but it didn't matter what they were. And when we'd finish opening them, it was Chester who said what we were all thinking.
I just want to say, Miss Kitty, Doc, you, Mr. Dillon, I just want to say that this is the best doggone Christmas I ever had, and that's what I want to say.
Say, you was going to tell me about that fella John who was courting that woman. What was her name?
Oh, yeah, Ms. McNish. Well, she said yes. You've never seen two happier people in your whole life. Yeah, she's Ms. McNish Bumby now.
Well, that's good.
You know, you might settle for a bit in Dodge. You could get work there.
Sure would be fine if you could get back tonight, wouldn't it?
Well, it can't be helped. I'd be a lot further away and a sight more tired if you hadn't come along.
Yeah, well, listen. How far you figure it'll be before there's a place you might pick up a horse?
Oh, I don't know. 15 miles or so, maybe?
Well, we're not going to make any 15 miles on this nag tonight, that's for sure.
Well, that's all right.
I'll tell you what. You go on alone, you see?
Oh, no, forget it.
No, you go on alone. She can hold out with one man on her, and then you get a fresh horse, and you ride into Dodge tonight.
Well, thanks. That's very kind, but...
I'm telling you. I want you to go. I'll be fine. I've walked before. Probably make it almost as quick as you.
Well, now look. It's real nice of you, Mr. Cowley, but no thanks.
Christmas don't mean nothing to me. You got friends waiting for you.
I'll see them tomorrow.
Ah, you're a fool.
Well, that may be.
All them nice folks, you'll make them feel pretty bad.
Look, I'll stay if you want to go along, but thanks for the ride.
Well, we might as well make camp then.
I guess so.
And listen, you want to tell me some more about what you was telling me before we turn in?
Well, sure.
I'd take it kindly, mister. Well, get yourself settled. I've got some stuff in my pack we can eat and maybe use to get a fire going. Then after we eat, you can tell me some more.
We made a fire, then shared what we had for supper. He seemed to soften up after that, and we talked for a couple or 3 hours. It was like he was starved for news of people, everyday things, and just plain company. And that's how we spent Christmas Eve together out on the plain. Then, when the fire was dying down and I was about ready for sleep, he said,
Marshal?
Yeah?
I want to tell you something. I've been needing to tell it for a long time. Do you mind?
Of course, I don't mind.
Well, then, I'll tell you. A few years ago, I was skipper of a little schooner. I used to sail up and down the East Coast, you know. Boston, New York.
Yeah?
Well, one night we hit dirty weather off New Jersey. Real dirty. Blew us off course and we piled up on the rocks and knocked the bottom out.
Oh, that's too bad.
There was 18 passengers aboard, Marshal. 4 of them was kids. We never saw them again. My own wife and my kid went down too.
I'm sorry.
Well, now, something must have happened to me after that. I didn't want nothing to do with the ships or the sea. I started to drift out this way. I couldn't forget, though, you know, and I didn't want to be near folks, especially kids, to remind me, you know?
Yeah.
That's how I come to be slewing around ever since.
Sure. I understand.
I just kind of wanted to get it off my chest.
Sure.
Marshal? I'd like to ride into Dodge with you tomorrow. You think I might meet some of them folks you was telling about?
Oh, I don't see why not.
That'd be all right. Maybe I wouldn't need to drift no more. Maybe I could drop anchor, you know?
Yeah, you might at that.
Yes. Well, good night.
Good night.
Merry Christmas, Marshal.
Merry Christmas, Mr. Cowley.
We hope you've enjoyed Radioactive Theater's production of 2 episodes of Gunsmoke. We thank our sponsors, the Webster Five Foundation and the Worcester Arts Council, a local agency, which is supported by the Massachusetts Cultural Council, a state agency. This program was produced and directed by Catherine Thornton, John McManaman, and Diane DeGon. Tune in again next time for Radioactive Theater, a production of Audio Journal. To finish up our Western Hour, here's RAT's Joe Aguirre reading a favorite Bret Hart story, Tennessee's Partner.
I do not think that we ever knew his real name. Our ignorance of it certainly never gave us any social inconvenience, for at Sandy Bar in 1854, most men were christened anew. Sometimes these appellatives were derived from some distinctiveness of dress, as in the case of Dungaree Jack, or from some peculiarity of habit, as shown in Saleratus Bill, so called from an undue proportion of that chemical in his daily bread, or for some unlucky slip, as exhibited in The Iron Pirate, a mild, inoffensive man who earned that baleful title by his unfortunate mispronunciation of the term iron pyrites. Perhaps this may have been the beginning of a rude heraldry, but I am constrained to think that it was because a man's real name in that day rested solely upon his own unsupported statement. But to return to Tennessee's partner, whom we never knew by any other than this relative title, that he had ever existed as a separate and distinct individuality, we only learned later. It seems that in 1853 he left Poker Flat to go to San Francisco, ostensibly to procure a wife. He never got any farther than Stockton. At that place he was attracted by a young person who waited upon the table at the hotel where he took his meals. One morning he said something to her which caused her to smile not unkindly, to somewhat coquettishly break a plate of toast over his upturned, serious, simple face, and to retreat to the kitchen. He followed her and emerged a few moments later, covered with more toast and victory. That very week they were married by a justice of the peace and returned to Poker Flat. I am aware that something more might be made of this episode, but I prefer to tell it as was current at Sandy Bar, in the gulches and bar rooms, where all sentiment was modified by a strong sense of humor. Of their married felicity, but little is known, perhaps for the reason that Tennessee, then living with his partner, one day took occasion to say something to the bride on his own account, at which, it is said, she smiled not unkindly and chastely retreated, this time as far as Marysville, where Tennessee followed her, and where they went to housekeeping, without the aid of a justice of the peace. Tennessee's partner took the loss of his wife simply and seriously, as was his fashion. But to everybody's surprise, when Tennessee one day returned from Marysville without his partner's wife, she having smiled and retreated with somebody else, Tennessee's partner was the first man to shake his hand and greet him with affection. The boys who had gathered in the canyon to see the shooting were naturally indignant. Their indignation might have found vent in sarcasm, but for a certain look in Tennessee's partner's eye that indicated a lack of humorous appreciation. In fact, he was a grave man with a steady application to practical detail, which was unpleasant in a difficulty. Meanwhile, a popular feeling against Tennessee had grown up on the bar. He was known to be a gambler. He was suspected to be a thief. In these suspicions, Tennessee's partner was equally compromised. His continued intimacy with Tennessee after the affair above quoted could only be accounted for on the hypotheses of a co-partnership of crime. At last, Tennessee's guilt became flagrant. One day he overtook a stranger on his way to Red Dog. The stranger afterward related that Tennessee beguiled the time with interesting anecdote and reminiscence, but illogically concluded the interview in the following words: "And now, young man, I'll trouble you for your knife, your pistols, and your money. You see, your weapons might get you into trouble at Red Dog, and your money's a temptation to the evilly disposed. I think you and your address was San Francisco. I shall endeavor to call." It may be stated here that Tennessee had a fine flow of humor, which no business preoccupation could wholly subdue. This exploit was his last. Red Dog and Sandy Bar made common cause against the highwayman. Tennessee was hunted in very much the same fashion as his prototype, the grizzly. As the toils closed around him, he made a desperate dash through the bar, emptying his revolver at the crowd before the arcade saloon, and so on up Grizzly Canyon, but at its farther extremity he was stopped by a small man on a gray horse. The men looked at each other a moment in silence. Both were fearless, both self-possessed and independent, and both types of a civilization that in the 17th century would have been called heroic, but in the 19th, simply reckless. "What have you got there?" "I call," said Tennessee quietly. "Two Boers and an ace," said the stranger, as quietly, showing two revolvers and a bowie knife. "That takes me," returned Tennessee, and with this gambler's epigram, he threw away his useless pistol and rode back with his captor. The trial of Tennessee was conducted as fairly as was consistent with the judge and jury, who felt themselves to some extent obliged to justify, in their verdict, the previous irregularities of arrest and indictment. The law of Sandy Bar was implacable, but not vengeful. The excitement and personal feeling of the chase were over. With Tennessee safe in their hands, they were ready to listen patiently to any defense, which they were already satisfied was insufficient. There being no doubt in their own minds, they were willing to give the prisoner the benefit of any that might exist. Secure in the hypothesis that he ought to be hanged on general principles, they indulged him with more latitude of defense than his reckless hardihood seemed to ask. The judge appeared to be more anxious than the prisoner, who, otherwise unconcerned, evidently took a grim pleasure in the responsibility he had created. "I don't take any hand in this here game," had been his invariable but good-humored reply to all questions. The judge, who was also his captor, for a moment vaguely regretted that he had not shot him on sight that morning, but presently dismissed this human weakness as unworthy of the judicial mind. Nevertheless, when there was a tap at the door, and it was said that Tennessee's partner was there on behalf of the prisoner, he was admitted at once without question. Perhaps the younger members of the jury, to whom the proceedings were becoming exceedingly irksomely thoughtful, hailed him as a relief. For he was not certainly an imposing figure. Short and stout, with a square face sunburned into preternatural redness, clad in a loose duck jumper and trousers streaked and splashed with red soil, his aspect under any circumstances would have been quaint, and was now even ridiculous. As he stooped to deposit at his feet a heavy carpet bag he was carrying, it became obvious, from partially developed legends and inscriptions, that the material with which his trousers had been patched had been originally intended for a less ambitious covering. Yet he advanced with great gravity, and after having shaken the hand of each person in the room with labored cordiality, he wiped his serious, perplexed face on a red bandana handkerchief, a shade lighter than his complexion, laid his powerful hand upon the table to steady himself, and thus addressed the judge.
"I was passing by," he began, by way of apology, "and I thought I'd just step in and see how things was getting on with Tennessee there, my partner. It's a hot night. I disremember any such weather before on the bar." He paused a moment, but nobody volunteering any other meteorological recollection, he again had recourse to his pocket handkerchief, and for some moments mopped his face diligently. "Have you anything to say in behalf of the prisoner?" said the judge finally. "That's it," said Tennessee's partner, in a tone of relief. "I come yar as Tennessee's partner, knowing him nigh on 4 year, off and on, wet and dry, in luck and out of luck. His ways ain't allers my ways, but they ain't any points in that young man there. Ain't any liveliness as he's been up to as I don't know. And you says to me, says you, confidential like, and between man and man, says you, do you know anything in his behalf? And I says to you, says I, confidential like, as between man and man, what should a man know of his partner?" "Is that all you have to say?" asked the judge impatiently, feeling, perhaps, that a dangerous sympathy of humor was beginning to humanize the court. "That's so," continued Tennessee's partner. "It ain't for me to say anything agin him. And now, what's the case? Here's Tennessee wants money, wants it bad, and doesn't like to ask it of his old partner. Well, what does Tennessee do? He lays for a stranger, and he fetches that stranger. And you lays for him, and you fetches him.
and the honors is easy. And I put it to you, being a fair-minded man, and to you gentlemen all, as fair-minded men, if this ain't so. Prisoner, said the judge, interrupting, have you any questions to ask this man? No, no, continued Tennessee's partner, hastily. I played this here hand alone. To come down to the bedrock, it's just this. Tennessee, dar, has played it pretty rough and expensive-like on a stranger, and on this here camp. And now, what's the fair thing? Some would say more, some would say less. Here's $1,700 in coarse gold and a watch. It's about all my pile, and call it square. And before a hand could be raised to prevent him, he had emptied the contents of the carpet bag upon the table. For a moment, his life was in jeopardy. One or two men sprang to their feet. Several hands groped for hidden weapons, and a suggestion to throw him from the window was only overridden by a gesture from the judge. Tennessee laughed, and apparently oblivious of the excitement, Tennessee's partner improved the opportunity to mop his face again with his handkerchief. When order was restored, and the man was made to understand by the use of forcible figures and rhetoric that Tennessee's offense could not be condoned by money, his face took a more serious and sanguinary hue, and those who were nearest to him noticed that his rough hand trembled slightly on the table. He hesitated a moment as he slowly returned the gold to the carpet bag, as if he had not yet entirely caught the elevated sense of justice which swayed the tribunal, and was perplexed with the belief that he had not offered enough. Then he turned to the judge and saying, "This year is a lone hand, played alone and without my partner," bowed to the jury and was about to withdraw when the judge called him back. "If you have anything to say to Tennessee, you'd better say it now." For the first time that evening, the eyes of the prisoner and his strange advocate met. Tennessee smiled, showed his white teeth, and saying, "Euchred, old man," held out his hand. Tennessee's partner took it in his own, and saying, "I just dropped in as I was passing to see how things was getting on," let the hand passively fall, and, adding that it was a warm night, again mopped his face with his handkerchief, and without another word, withdrew. The two men never again met each other alive, for the unparalleled insult of a bribe offered to Judge Lynch, who, whether bigoted, weak, or narrow, was at least incorruptible, firmly fixed in the mind of that mythical personage any wavering determination of Tennessee's fate, and, at the break of day, he was marched, closely guarded, to meet it at the top of Marley's Hill. Tennessee's partner was not in the group that surrounded the ominous tree, but as they turned to disperse, attention was drawn to the singular appearance of a motionless donkey cart halted at the side of the road. As they approached, they at once recognized the venerable Jenny and the two-wheeled cart as the property of Tennessee's partner, used by him in carrying dirt from his claim, and a few paces distant, the owner of the equipage himself, sitting under a buckeye tree, wiping the perspiration from his glowing face. In answer to an inquiry, he said he had come for the body of the deceased, if it was all the same to the committee. He didn't wish to hurry anything, and he would wait. He was not working that day, and when the gentlemen were done with the deceased, he would take him, if there is any present, he added, in his simple, serious way, as would care to join in the funeral, they can come. Perhaps it was from a sense of humor, which I have already intimated was a feature of Sandy Bar. Perhaps it was from something even better than that, but two-thirds of the loungers accepted the invitation at once. It was noon when the body of Tennessee was delivered into the hands of his partner. As the cart drew up to the fatal tree, we noticed that it contained a rough oblong box, apparently made from a section of sluicing and half-filled with bark and the tassels of pine. The cart was further decorated with slips of willow and made fragrant with buckeye blossoms. When the body was deposited in the box, Tennessee's partner drew over it a piece of tarred canvas, and gravely mounting the narrow seat in front, with his feet upon the shafts, urged the little donkey forward. The equipage moved slowly on at that decorous pace which was habitual with Jenny, even under less solemn circumstances. The way led through Grizzly Canyon, by this time clothed in funereal drapery and shadows. The redwoods, burying their moccasined feet in the red soil, stood in Indian file along the track, trailing an uncouth benediction from their bending boughs upon the passing bier. A hare, surprised into helpless inactivity, sat upright and pulsating in the ferns by the roadside as the cortege went by. Squirrels hastened to gain a secure outlook from higher boughs, and the blue jays, spreading their wings, fluttered before them like outriders under the outskirts of Sandy Bar, until those were reached and the solitary cabin of Tennessee's partner. A few paces from the cabin, there was a rough enclosure which, in the days of Tennessee's partner's matrimonial felicity, had been used as a garden, but was now overgrown with fern. As we approached it, we were surprised to find that what we had taken for a recent attempt at cultivation was the broken soil of an open grave. The cart was hailed before the enclosure, and rejecting offers of assistance with the same air of simple self-reliance he had displayed throughout, Tennessee's partner lifted the rough coffin on his back and deposited it, unaided, within the shallow grave. He then nailed down the board which served as a lid, and, mounting the little mound of earth beside it, took off his hat and slowly mopped his face with his handkerchief. This, the crowd felt, was a preliminary to speech, and they disposed themselves variously on stumps and boulders and sat expectant. "When a man," began Tennessee's partner, slowly, "has been running free all day, what's the natural thing for him to do? Why, to come home. And if he ain't in a condition to go home, what can his best friend do? Why, bring him home. And here's Tennessee has been running free, and we brings him home from his wandering." He paused, picked up a fragment of quartz, rubbed it thoughtfully on his sleeve, and went on. "It ain't the first time I've packed him on my back, as you'd seen me now. It ain't the first time that I brought him to this here cabin when he couldn't help himself. And it ain't the first time that I and Jenny waited for him on that yon hill and picked him up so and fetched him home when he couldn't speak and he didn't know me. And now that it's the last time, why..." He paused and rubbed the quartz gently on his sleeve. "You see, it's sort of rough on his partner. And now, gentlemen," he added abruptly, picking up his long-handed shovel, "the funeral's over, and my thanks, and Tennessee's thanks to you for your trouble." Resisting any proffers of assistance, he began to fill in the grave, turning his back upon the crowd that, after a few minutes' hesitation, gradually withdrew. As they crossed the little ridge that hid Sandy Bar from view, some, looking back, thought they could see Tennessee's partner, his work done, sitting upon the grave, his shovel between his knees, and his face buried in his red bandana handkerchief. In the reaction that followed the feverish excitement of that day, Tennessee's partner was not forgotten. A secret investigation had cleared him of any complicity in Tennessee's guilt and left only a suspicion of his general sanity. Sandy Bar made a point of calling on him and proffering various uncouth but well-meant kindnesses. But from that day his rude health and great strength seemed visibly to decline, and when the rainy season fairly set in, and the tiny grass blades were beginning to peep from the rocky ground above Tennessee's grave, he took to his bed. One night when the pines beside the cabin were swaying in the storm and trailing their slender fingers over the roof, and the roar and rush of the swollen river were heard, Tennessee's partner lifted his head from the pillow, saying, "It's time to go for Tennessee. I must put Jenny in the cart," and would have risen from his bed but for the restraint of his attendant. Struggling, he still pursued his singular fancy. "There now, steady, Jenny. Steady, old gal. How dark it is. Look out for the ruts. And look out for him, too, old gal. Sometimes, you know, when he's blind drunk, he drops right down in the trail. Keep on straight up to the pine on the top of the hill. There, I told you so. There he is, coming this way, too, all by himself, sober, and his face a-shining. Tennessee, partner." And so they met.